This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking about this year's Heartland International Film Festival, which, like many things in 2020, is going to be different. Since this show was pre-taped, we can't take your questions or comments live, but we would love to hear what you think. Let us know on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. We're joined now by Greg Sorvik, Artistic Director for Heartland Film. Greg, thanks for taking the time.
Hey, thank you very much. I have really important things to do here in my basement, so it's a pleasure to be on.
Don't we all? So what is the Heartland Film Festival going to look like this year? How can people attend, if that's even the right word?
Yeah, I think the big buzzword that the industry is using now is hybrid. So it's not, and that is still in person, meaning mostly drive-in across the industry. Some theaters are opening up now, but we're not afforded that luxury to plan at the last second. So we just want to make sure everybody is safe. We have the best technology possible to show films as well, too. So basically, we are doing drive-in screenings and virtual screenings. So you can do it from the comfort of your home. You can use a Chromecast, a Roku box, and stream stuff on your actual TV or your laptop or iPad, whatever you prefer, in addition to screenings at the Tibbs Drive-In and Connor Prairie. We have a pop-up drive-in experience there too. So yeah, a lot of great opportunities. So if you want to do a drive-in experience, if you want to do it from home, a little bit of both, we have something for everyone.
I love going to drive-ins. Is it going to be a typical drive-in experience where you can tune in on the radio?
Yeah. So you can tune in over an FM frequency, but pun intended, we have a red carpet this year. So you can actually drive your car up to the red carpet and get your picture taken as well.
And you don't have to have a red car.
No, you don't. You know, that's a bonus. It might look better in the photo, but no, any car is welcome.
So how did you decide how you'd structure this? What was the process like to figure this out once we knew this was going to be the factor this year?
Yeah, you know, honestly, with the pandemic breaking out in February, March, there were bigger priorities in everyone's life than a film festival. So, you know, we just had to, you know, figure life out in general and then go from there, make sure everything was safe. And that the industry and the, you know, the public in general would like to move forward with arts opportunities and other things too. So we didn't quite know what would happen, but you know, luckily the industry has been so effective in finding new solutions and really setting a new pace for everything too. So we've been very fortunate where the biggest thing is we want to make sure filmmakers, you know, we have movies from all over the world, including studio content, to down to films that you know, people made bootstrapped and are just sitting out in the world at a film festival. We just want to make sure that safety is paramount, but also security. So, you know, I think people just think, you know, you think of a film online, you think of going to YouTube, but obviously now there's Netflix and other streaming services. So the experience between a film festival and Netflix are two totally different things, but we've tried to find something in between to accommodate, you know, people's viewing habits and structures, but still maintaining a fun, festive experience where you can interact with filmmakers and other moviegoers.
Would you say that knowing how it was going to go, this sort of hybrid schedule, virtual versus drive-in, did that affect the film selection in any way, would you say?
Yeah, I would say we had more films in last year because, you know, traditionally we're at multiple venues, including AMC locations. We've been at AMC Traders Point, AMC Castleton. We've been at Newfields. We've been at other pop-up locations as well, the Artcraft Theater down in Franklin. And, you know, we would take over multiple theaters. We'd have, you know, 9+ screens running multiple films a day. So just the amount of blocks that we had to show films, we could show so much more content. So we were very mindful this year. And just with, you know, if people watch X number of movies per day, if they want to still do a marathon, because people would go run around and see 5 films a day in person, which would be pretty wild. But we wanted to maintain that. We wanted quality over quantity as well. So we still have about 75 feature films from all around the world. And we're very happy with that lineup. But yes, we did reduce the amount of films, but it's still a lot to choose from.
I know some film festivals have just flat out been canceled, but others are on, just like yours, the Heartland International Film Festival. Did you look to what other festivals that were going to continue this year and actually do their festival? Did you look at what they were doing and base what they were doing on what you decided to do, or did you just decide to do it your own way?
Yeah, we did a little bit of both. And the actual thing that, you know, we were very lucky because we have two festivals. You know, the Heartland has been around. This is the 29th year. We expanded to a short film festival, so films under 40 minutes, called Indie Shorts 3 years ago. So we actually did this already in July. So it was a lot more, we keep using the word uncertain times and stuff now too, but that was really kind of our guinea pig experience. So what we did is that we did look at what other film festivals were doing. So we did drive-in screenings in addition to the secure virtual. And some of the best practices now, you can geofencing or geoblocking is a term being used where basically you can limit who is watching by their VPN on their computer. So if you're only in the United States, you can limit it to that and kind of go that route. So we had actually a worldwide audience, which was unique because usually, you know, if you have a physical screening, you can only be here in Indiana or travel to Indiana to experience those films. So we had an international and national audience watching the short films. We're going to have the same for Heartland coming up too. But yeah, we just wanted to make sure we had a good virtual platform that filmmakers and distributors trusted, which we do with our partners with Eventive. So there are maybe three or four platforms that have been kind of industry leaders at this point. So we did that. But I think that was very unique. A lot of film festivals are having pre-recorded Q&A sessions with filmmakers. For Indie Shorts, we did live Q&As. So actually audience members can still ask questions and see filmmakers live. You can still have that experience. So we're doing that again for Heartland. And we're having most of our films in blocks of about 4 to 5 films. And you can interact with the filmmakers and we'll ask questions and go from there. So that was a little bit different. We've heard from filmmakers. We were some of the first live Q&As they did. So yeah, we're, you know, just doing what the industry has been successful for other festivals, but in addition to trying new things as well. And we've had great feedback. So we're really hoping to have another great year and great festival with Heartland coming up October 8th through the 18th.
We're talking about the Heartland International Film Festival with the artistic director for Heartland Film, Greg Sorvig. So what about the audience? I mean, has it been a challenge making sure people still know it's happening? Have some people said, I assume it's canceled this year? And you say, no, it isn't.
Yeah, we had that even from some filmmakers who are submitting films. Like, oh, yeah, I'm assuming you're gonna cancel. And, you know, we did our due diligence. We had multiple contingency plans just in case. But luckily, things did work out for us to move forward. And the thing we were really worried about with Indie Shorts was that, you know, there's the technology gap. You know, are people going to be able to watch the film successfully? We were really surprised, got great feedback. And the fact that, you know, people can watch films once you redeem a ticket for a film or a film program. For most films, you have a time frame to watch that. So in this case, you know, if you watch a film, most films at Heartland coming up and you, digitally, you can watch it for up to 72 hours. So, you know, with people's schedules, we do that too. But the attendance for Indie Shorts was actually higher than it was in person the year before. So we went into all the planning and the events thinking, oh man, we have really limited expectations, but we've been very surprised by the audiences and how enthusiastic people really have been. So pre-sales have already been really great, and we're tracking to have another fantastic festival. So yeah, but I think that's the thing too. I think film festivals have been very scared and seeing streaming as a challenge. So, you know, I think the silver lining to this pandemic is that it has given us kick in the pants to adjust to the habits of our audiences with movie going as well. So what we saw as a Band-Aid in terms of the technology and approach, there might be, you know, factors and things we're using that we'll still implement even after the pandemic. So, yeah, audiences have been very flexible. They've been very reactive, and they've been very willing. So we've been very fortunate to have great fans.
How do you feel, though, about the experience people are going to have? I mean, part of the appeal of going to a film festival is actually going, being in that environment. And you kind of got that with the hybrid schedule and you know, having some drive-in films. But there's a big convenience factor in just clicking a button at home. What about that experience?
Yeah, you know, there is, you know, something sacred about watching a film, going to a theater, the unadulterated experience of being in the dark room, experiencing the exact same thing without distraction. So, you know, that's the thing too. I think you know, if you scroll through Netflix, there's so much content that the value of what you're watching and the actual impact has been limited, I think, but by that consuming experience that we have on a daily basis. I spend more time usually picking something to watch than actually watching something at home too. So I think that's a little bit different, but I think, you know, you can't shake that process. You can't replace the real thing, but you know, we are in the 21st century. And I think you got to go with, what's what the audience wants. I think there's, you know, there's people that still like that experience. There's people that still like digital. So I think the biggest thing to me is that you just have to have more discipline. If you're going to watch something with virtual, you have to be dedicated. You have to sit down, put away all other devices, you know, if I have five devices pinging or doing something else, and just enjoy the film. So I think there's definitely more self-discipline via virtual, but you can still go to the drive-in and enjoy a film with other moviegoers too.
Got about another minute left, and I want to make sure I get to this. You've always done work to highlight Indiana filmmakers. Has filmmaking started to pick back up yet? I mean, is it possible for relatively low-budget film crews to work safely?
Yeah, you know what? I can't go into details, but I know of some folks even working in Indiana nearby with some really impressive talent that everyone has heard of. So I think things are starting to pick up as safely as possible. And I think Indiana still has some great assets between Film Indiana, you know, Film Indie, a lot of other great things, art house cinemas like the Can-Can Theater and other places for filmmakers to work together as a hub. Indiana Filmmakers Network, they continue to be a great resource as well. So I think there are still great resources and things are starting to pick up. So there's still the constant pursuit for credits and incentives, but people still are making films in Indiana, and we honor them through our Indiana Spotlight program.
And just real quick, in maybe 10 seconds, do you think this could change how Heartland does the festival in future years, even after the pandemic is behind us?
Definitely. I think we are very, you know, responsive. We have a lot of audience surveys, and if things, you know, if the audience enjoys what they see, I think we'll definitely be able to offer virtual and in-person experiences too. And it lets us interact with more filmmakers from around the world who otherwise could not come to Indiana. So we definitely want to embrace it.
Greg Sorvig is Artistic Director for Heartland Film. We're talking today about this year's Heartland International Film Festival, which will be held virtually and starts this week. Greg, thanks so much for your time.
Hey, thank you.
Best of luck this year. After a quick break, we'll hear from some of the filmmakers participating in the festival this year to find out what they made and what it's like releasing a movie right now. I'm Matt Pelzer, back in less than 2 minutes. This is All In. All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. We're talking today about this year's Heartland International Film Festival, which is being held online and kicks off this week. We're joined now by Nick Numerdor and Andrew J. Morgan, co-directors of the documentary Sleaze Lake, Van Life at its Lowest and Best. Nick, welcome.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for having us.
Absolutely. And Andrew, thanks for talking to us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us.
Nick, what's this movie about?
So Sleaze Lake, Van Life at its Lowest and Best, is kind of our love letter to 1970s boogie band culture that kind of had its high watermark in the mid-70s. And it's actually about a giant party that this band club out of Chicago and Northwest Indiana started. They're called Midwest Vans, and they threw this massive party in Monticello, Indiana in 1977. And really, the film is about the before, during, and after of that massive party.
How did you find out about it, Andrew?
So, yeah, I'll try to make a long story short. But really, what it came down to is I bought an old 70s Dodge van in about 2011, which I still own. And, you know, after buying that and kind of seeking for parts and tips on the internet, I came across the van culture. And basically, we went and filmed our first feature documentary called Vannin, which is out there on Amazon Prime that you can check out now, all about that culture. And so within filming those interviews for Vannin, we kept hearing the rumblings of this mythic party called Sleaze Lake. And, you know, when the word sleaze is in the name of it, I think you are obligated to ask a few more questions. And we did. And we did so for about 3 or 4 years. And then, you know, now we've got the new flick all about band culture and Sleaze Lake.
If I may ask, what is the current condition of your Dodge van?
The current condition of the Dodge van, it's in pretty good shape, honestly. I actually found it in Indiana, like in the Tippecanoe area, and it's not too bad. It's not all rusted out or anything like that. With the pandemic, though, it stayed in storage for a lot of this year. But, you know, I got the interior kind of built out. There's a bed in there. It's got the bubble windows, the vintage stuff in it and everything like that. So, it's running. It's on the road.
Carpet, speakers, amenities, things like that. It's would you liken it to sort of the classic vans of that era?
Absolutely. I mean, it is a classic van of that era for sure. I've got the wide tires on the back, you know, the slot mag wheels. I put side pipes on a year ago too, you know, to really kind of complete the look. So I love it. And it's actually shaped a lot of my life in the last, you know, almost 10 years now.
Nick, what was it like tracking down people to talk to who were at this event in the 1970s?
Good question. It actually was pretty easy because we had made that other Vannon film. So we automatically knew we had Howard was on board because he's such a well-spoken, like, awesome guy that we knew we had a through line because he's got like a great memory of a lot of these things. Even though he was like partying, he can recall like whose van was who and what year and what event. And, but beyond that, we had a couple initial interviews and, it was almost like 2 years into editing that we, found some of the other characters. And then even Kurt, we added in the film in the last just weeks before we had pretty much had a finished product. So it did kind of take some talking to and convincing. You know, it's like trying to convince your grandparents to talk about a party they went to 40 years ago. So it was fun and it wasn't too much trouble, but we always wish we could have had more, but you can't fit in too many voices either.
Was anyone, I don't know, I mean, you know, back at that time, maybe these people were in their maybe late teens and 20s, and a lot of us want to forget that time in our life. But how much, I'm sure the people who really didn't want to talk to you about it obviously didn't, but those that did, was there any hesitancy to recall some of those sordid moments?
I think that there was some hesitancy with some of the club members because this film is so much centered around Midwest Vans Limited, that club that Nick mentioned. And I think a few folks were kind of like, well, you know, like how extreme do you want me to get in some of these stories? You know, because there was a lot of openness in terms of, you know, possibly a little bit of smoking pot, and, you know, nudity, stuff like that. So there was a little bit of hesitation. It was an individual by individual basis, really. I think some people were a little bit more reserved, and then there's other people that were like, let me tell you all about, you know, this crazy story or that crazy story.
Was there a wide variety of people who were attracted to this scene, Andrew? Would you say?
Yeah, I think that there were, but I think that there's something unique about it in the Midwest. So van culture was kind of a fad, right, for lack of a better term, from like the late 60s to, you know, the mid to late 70s. It kind of came and went, and I think everybody was sort of into it a little bit across the country, but there was a special flavor of it in the Midwest, and I think it really has to do with the fact that it appealed to, you know, blue collar steel workers from Northwest Indiana, Southwest Chicago, kind of rough areas to grow up in. And, you know, the emphasis wasn't on how pretty your van was. It was about escaping, I think, some of that lifestyle, some of, you know, being trapped in Gary, Indiana, being trapped in, you know, Whiting, places like that. So the Midwest kind of had a special flavor of it. And Terry Cook, who's in the film and was the editor of Hot Rod Magazine at the time, you know, famously describes it, you know, just like that, where it's like the van's out west, you go to California and everything's perfect, the paint jobs and everything. You get out to the Midwest and the vans are dented and rusted, and, you know, and a little bit more rougher, and so are the people.
And yeah, it's basically that freedom on wheels.
And Nick, I mean, we heard from Andrew about his van. I don't know that means the culture is still around. I think to a degree, some people still have some of these vans. I know a couple of people that have cool vans. I don't know. Is this culture still around in some form, perhaps close to the form it took back in the 70s?
Yeah, Midwest Fans, the club that's in the film, still hosts their truck-in every Memorial Day weekend. And there are actual truck-ins all over the U.S. with different clubs. They're really like, it's like a big family. The people that were hardcore into it, a lot of them are still vanning.
Nick, how did others view people who were part of this culture back then? I mean, what was the perception among the broader populace, I guess?
I mean, from my perspective, and I can't speak for everyone, but I think they were considered a little bit like bikers, like rough around the edges, like youth gone wild. It's like kind of seeing like a heavy metal band roll through your town. And when they came, the vanners were a lot of times in big groups. So you would see like a line form. So there'd be like 10 vans rolling through your small town in order to get to their next party that was happening.
Andrew, do you think there's a reason this event happened in Indiana, in Monticello, as opposed to, well, I guess just in Indiana, as opposed to any other state?
You know, there's always been a big vanning culture in the Midwest, in Indiana, in Ohio, and places like that. So I think that it's like a centrally located area, which is, perhaps part of why it was there. But also you had Midwest Vans that was based out of there, and they were really at the forefront of the culture as well.
Nick, I want to get an idea of what made you do the first documentary, Vannin, and then, of course, this follow-up, Sleaze Lake. How did you come up with the idea to do Vannin, and then, which then took you, of course, down this road to that eventually culminated in Sleaze Lake, the film that'll be premiering?
Oh, wow. So I've just always been interested in subcultures. I kind of grew up doing DIY shows and like concerts and like punk rock stuff in West Michigan. So everybody was kind of like doing their own thing. And then I was in skateboard culture too. So there was like this interest in documenting what you were doing. And then when I started going to film school and discovering different cool documentaries and stuff, I was always way more attracted to stuff about subcultures or stuff I had never heard of, more so than like maybe social issue films. And so when we kind of found out about this boogie van culture, I had seen boogie vans my whole life, and I liked the film The Van. And, you know, there's a cool van in Rock and Roll High School. And we just decided it would be really cool to meet up with these people that were still doing it 40 years later. And we were just going to make like a 10-minute web piece. We just went in with a small crew and simple equipment and didn't have high expectations. And it just turned into be a real shot in the arm for our documentary filmmaking efforts.
Andrew, any follow-up to that?
No, Nick pretty much covered it. You know, I think that some of our favorite films and things like that, that we, you know, I think everybody tries to emulate some of the favorite stuff that they've seen in the doc world. You know, there's the film Heavy Metal Parking Lot and, you know, all about going to a Judas Priest concert. We kind of approached it like that, where it's like, hey, let's just like go into this field and ask the question why. And yeah, the subculture thing is super appealing to us, because I think that that's, you know, to Nick's point about punk rock and everything, that's sort of the culture that we come from, the do-it-yourself culture. I was always in a band in high school, and anybody that was in a band and, you know, around that, those years of your life, it's like you got to make your own flyers and, you know, do your own thing. And that's also something just with documentary period that really is invaluable about it. You know, it's a format that allows you to just like go out and really do it yourself. You got a camera, you got some sound gear and a little bit of knowledge. It's like you can go out as a two-man crew and do it.
Nick, were you still in some stage of the production on this when the pandemic hit? How much did the pandemic, I guess, affect how this movie got made?
Well, it pushed back its release a little bit. We were well into editing in March, and we were set to premiere at the Calgary Underground Film Festival and San Francisco Documentary Film Festival in the spring, around April. And of course, we didn't know what was going on then, but those were postponed. And what it really did is gave us till June, gave us those extra couple months to just really, really refine the film to what we wanted. So I actually think the film improved from the pandemic in a way, but it's been weird distributing it and doing film festivals. We're in about a dozen. We've done a few, we're doing a few more, and they've all been virtual. So we have the drive-in film festival, or the drive-in at TIBS on the 11th, and that's going to be cool.
Andrew, I mean, can you speak to that a little bit as well? Having a little extra time to finish a movie. I mean, there's a quote among filmmakers. I think it's a George Lucas quote. You never finish a film, you only abandon it. Having that extra time, was that invaluable, or were those just tiny corrections that were made?
Oh gosh. You know, I think it was kind of invaluable in some sense. It was, you know, I think that we were ready to abandon it, you know, a few months prior, and then this pandemic happened and it really helped us, you know, give us the time to really, really polish the edges. I don't know that it was big changes. Like, we didn't make any, you know, huge alterations to the film. Like, oh, let's take this whole scene and put it over here or something. It was kind of fine tuned, but really what it was really kind of like taking the fine grit sandpaper and going over it and like every little corner, making sure that the graphics were the best that they could be, you know, things like that. So I think it's a much better film, oddly, because of the pandemic. I think that we're really, like Nick said, you know, we're really looking forward to the TIBS drive-in this coming Sunday, because it'll be our first chance to see it on a big screen and see it with other people around us, basically, you know, even though we might not be able to hear the reactions through the car windows.
Bring in the van, Andrew?
No, the van is in Michigan right now. That's where I store it, actually. So unfortunately not. It is, it's kind of, like I said, because of the pandemic, a lot of the van events that still go on were canceled this year. And, you know, so I just sort of left the van where it is. But now I'm regretting it with the, you know, the prospect of this drive-in on Sunday.
Have you heard from anybody else who's going to be there and maybe bringing a van, doing it in fine style?
Yeah, so I'm actually a member of Midwest Vans Limited, the club featured in the film, and I know that some of those guys and gals are going to try to make it down. Howard, who is in the film, will be there in attendance, as far as I know, and you know, I'm sure a few of them will use their vans as the chariots to get down 65 from Chicago and get there.
So of course you'll be there, but there's nothing like seeing a film, whatever kind of film, documentary, it doesn't matter, in person with an audience among other people. What kind of value is there in that compared to what's going to happen with your film at the drive-in?
Gosh, I think that, you know, I guess I'll take that answer, or, you know, question. It's seeing it in a theater with people. It's interesting how you can almost pick up on the vibes, you know what I mean? Because you're in close quarters with people, you can sense that kind of, like, if they think it's funny, if they're bored, if they're having a good time. And that's such a huge thing that, you know, is missing from the pandemic thing right now. So I guess, you know, I hope I answered the question in terms of the differences there.
But Nick, there's a little something to be said about seeing it at a drive-in and it being the movie that it is, no?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a perfect drive-in film. It's 59 minutes, and it's paced really quickly, so it's just enough for a great late-night feature, to not take things so seriously, to be amongst automobiles and kind of old technology, and I think it's going to be awesome. I grew up going to the drive-in. There's a drive-in in Muskegon, Michigan, where Andrew and I both grew up, and yeah, we used to go in a, you know, a custom van that our buddy had, because it was the cheapest vehicle you could get in, you know, the 90s. It's an old Dodge van. So, yeah, we'd fill it up with kids and go to the drive-in on Tuesday night and catch the double feature. So to see my own film at a drive-in is, like, going to have its own special thing that I'm not even prepared for. But seeing your film that you've worked on for years, that you've worked on with your best friend, with any crowd, it's always electrifying, even if it's 5 people or 500 people. You know, that's what we live for.
I know you're a team, but Nick, I'll ask you this first. Do you have plans for anything new after this is done, or are things on hold until everything opens up again?
Oh, we always have ideas swirling around. We might have a project about public skate parks possibly in the works, kind of a follow-up to another thing that we did. And we're working on a film about female dog mushing in the Midwest. and a film about kind of skateboarding and gang life in Little Village, Chicago. And Andrew was just fortunate enough to do a bunch of puppet cinematography for the upcoming Candyman film, which keeps having its release date pushed back.
Mm-hmm. Andrew, any follow-up to that in the last 15 seconds we have?
Yeah, just that, you know, with everything getting pushed back, that was one of the kind of like the more amazing things that I've been able to be a part of is that the new, you know, Jordan Peele produced Candyman film and doing, you know, some shadow puppetry cinematography that's going to be included in it. And now it just keeps getting pushed back further and further and further. So I can't wait to also, you know, enjoy that on any screen, the big screen or small.
Nick Numidor and Andrew J. Morgan are co-directors of the documentary Sleaze Lake, Van Life at its Lowest and Best. Nick, thank you so much for taking the time.
Awesome. So bad. So glad to be here.
Andrew, good luck with the movie.
All right. Thanks so much. And hopefully we'll see you at the drive-in.
We'll be back after a quick break. We're talking to the filmmakers who are part of the Heartland International Film Festival, which is mostly online this year and kicks off this week. I'm Matt Pelser, back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to our discussion on this year's Heartland International Film Festival, which is being hosted online and starts this week. And a quick note before our final segment. Since this show was pre-taped, we can't take your questions or comments live, but we would love to hear what you think. Let us know on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. We're joined now by Moo Sun and Stephen Ritz, who are behind the documentary Generation Growth. Moo Sun, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And Steven, thanks for joining us.
Hello, Hoosiers. I am all in. Let's do it.
Moo, so let's get the back cover synopsis. What's Generation Growth about?
So Generation Growth is really a film about students. And it's a film about Steven and his work to try to bring equity to in education and health to students around America. And one of the places that we end up going to is in Indianapolis and in southeastern Indiana, and to try to essentially bring health and education to children in marginalized communities. Now he has a program that helps grow vegetables in the classroom, but really it does a lot more. It helps kids get engaged in school. It gives them pathway to jobs and allows them to be healthier students, and that's what the movie's all about. It's about expanding his vision throughout America.
Moo, why did you want to make this? I mean, what about it lends itself to being a documentary?
Well, Stephen, I mean, you can't see this because it's on the radio, but he's a very eccentric character. He's a lot of fun, and you'll hear from him. He's just a lot of fun to hang around with, and he's just a great character to follow, and he's just so passionate about what he does. And the other thing is that his work is very important. You know, he's all about equity, and you know, in America where so many things are unequal, to have an equity warrior like Steven go out and try to really enact change from an educational standpoint is really phenomenal and really an important story to tell, especially in these times.
Well, let's hear from the man himself. Steven, can you tell us what you do for a living?
Well, I like to say I grow vegetables, and my vegetables grow students. My students grow schools. My schools grow communities, and my communities become resilient entities. But at the end of the day, I am one man on a mission determined to make sure that every child in America has a healthy plate of food and every classroom is equipped with a competent teacher, and that the two are not exclusive but can be absolutely inclusive and collectively grow something greater.
So, I mean, what value is there in learning how to grow food for kids in poor communities? What's the value there? I mean, aside from the obvious, I guess.
Well, aside from the obvious, now more than ever, communities need food. Now more than ever, communities need access to healthy food. And let's be real, the most important school supply in the world is food, especially if you don't have access to it. And when talk about performance, what do we know? Food is fuel for performance. So let's talk Indianapolis 500. You wouldn't be putting vinegar in those race car engines. I want to make sure that my little students have the best food possible to fuel their minds, their body, and their performance in school. And when you do that, all kinds of amazing things happen, including changing the social determinants of health and physical and behavioral outcomes for the rest of their lives.
Stephen, how would you characterize the state of food education in the country right now? What does it look like?
The state of food education is awful. You know, we are living in a nation that, you know, celebrates $200 sneakers made in China and the 99-cent menu that subsidizes corporations that are slowly and painfully killing our children. So we've got to really look at what we're feeding them, how we're feeding them, how we're growing food, producing food. But, you know, that's a bigger conversation for sure. But most importantly, when you can get children excited about growing something that is good for them, that is healthy for them, and align it to key school performance indicators, OMG, that is the recipe for awesome sauce, Matt. I mean, to think about it, a school like Holy Angels in the middle of Indianapolis that, you know, rose up against all odds to become a finalist in the Governor's Award this year, that's the kind of progress, that's the kind of achievement, and that's the kind of accomplishment we could all be proud of.
Moo, can you kind of paint sort of the background of this picture and explain what the phrase food insecurity means for people who might not be familiar?
Sure. Food insecurity is when you don't know where your next meal is coming from. So what that could mean is, you know, you don't have access to the grocery store. You know, you could be living in a food desert and you don't have access to an actual grocery store. All you have access to is maybe a mini mart that sells, you know, processed food and packaged food. It could mean that you don't have enough money to buy food. Even if you have access to a grocery store, you don't have money to buy good, healthy produce. So the issue is that this is a pervasive problem throughout all of America, and especially in Indianapolis. And one of the things that we did a lot of research in throughout making this film was seeing how bad food insecurity was around Indianapolis. And something like 20% of children in Indianapolis, in Marion County, are food insecure, which is, you know, appalling, especially for a state that it's known as a farming state. And, you know, the main issue is that a lot of the crops that are grown in Indiana are not for human consumption. And so there's an irony there, is that, you know, we have all this food that is grown in this country. It's just not being given. There's not being given access to by the people that need it the most. And so that is something we definitely want to raise awareness in this film about, is that, you know, and as Stephen says, food fuels minds. You can't be well educated unless you're well fed. And so this is a big problem. And if we really want to look at some of the problems that we have in terms of education and educational and health outcomes in the country, we really have to start with food.
Stephen Ritz, you took your effort on the road. How'd that come about?
I think, you know, success begets more success. And as charming and good looking as I am, although you can't see that, this is really a data driven program that is based on years of success. And what it really allows schools to experience is whole school academic change. This is not just Stephen the salad guy or Stephen the vegetable. It is the art and science of growing vegetables aligned to whole school, all subject daily instruction. It is a prescriptive playbook for teachers to enhance all kinds of key performance school indicators, as well as behavioral outcomes and eating habits. So this is kind of the culmination, I guess, of 20 some odd years of professional experience and leadership experience and education aligned to a very critical mission at this point in time in our nation. The fact that we as a nation are eating ourselves to death, and there is a growing and increasingly growing portion of our population that does not have access to healthy food and is literally eating themselves sick and stupid and diseased and diseased. And we literally have the ability to change that overnight. So capturing this work across the nation, I've always said this work is not about me, it's about we. So one of the things that I think the film so eloquently and elegantly captures is not my work, but the work that teachers do each and every day. And that is so wonderfully reflected in this film that you just walk away and you scream, wow, teachers change lives. And you see how together we can put unity back into community.
We're talking to Stephen Ritz and Mu Sun, who are behind the documentary Generation Growth, which will be shown at this year's Heartland International Film Festival. So, Stephen, if we could look at what is taught, can you go in order of how you kind of explain this to students?
So, literally, this is a 9-week sequential program of science, math, language arts, history, cooking, test prep, projects, all aligned to this project-based learning experience of growing food from seed to harvest. And literally, the film Generation Growth follows these students week by week around the nation as they are engaged in this program. And whether they are urban students or the amazing students I met in Dearborn County out in Morris Hill with a population of 400 people, and to see quality of teaching and quality of learning around quality of food, and to see the champion teachers. And let me tell you, I traveled across the great state of Indiana. I saw more farmland than I ever saw in my life. I even went to my first Walmart in Indiana. The thing was bigger than my whole neighborhood. It was insane. But the quality of teaching, the sense of community, whether it was in downtown Indianapolis or small towns across the state, it was remarkable. And to see Hoosiers come together to support their children, to support public education, and really rally around what matters was really spectacular. I feel like I've grown an extended family.
You say you were in Dearborn County? That's where I grew up. That's fantastic.
Well, all the more reason for you to see the film. I hope you join me on October 11th at the Tibbs Drive-In. I'm literally going to be jumping out of an airplane wearing a cheese hat to attend the drive-in, and I will personally bring you a cheese hat, Matt, if you come.
Stephen, I'm going to get back to you, but Mu, I got to ask. So, so many issues around food insecurity are so deeply connected to issues around poverty, which can then quickly become an overwhelmingly complicated topic to talk about. And I don't know, to convey it in something like a documentary would take a series. So what was it like navigating that complexity when you made this and finding the focus that you did?
Yeah, poverty is a huge issue. And that's that was really our starting point. Because when you talk about issues of food access, a lot of it starts with poverty. But obviously, many documentaries cover poverty. We don't want to just be part of the echo chamber. You know, we wanted to have a different access point. And so what we ended up focusing on was the social determinants of health, which is essentially the aspects of your environment that affect your health that are not necessarily what's inside your body. And what that means is it's things like access to healthcare, access to transportation, access to healthy food that ultimately have such a big impact on how your health is, not necessarily with just how healthy you are in general. So what we look at is all the aspects of an impoverished family's environment that really contribute to them having poor health outcomes. And a big part of that is diet. And so, you know, when we're able to focus on the one aspect of diet that sort of stems out, it sort of gives access to all these other different problems. That's how we're able to really talk about the issue in a very pointed way. And so that's sort of where Steven's program, and that's how Green Bronco Machine really fits into the equation, because once you give students this access to healthy food, then it really opens up their lives in so many different ways. Once they become healthy, then they are better educated. Once they're better educated, they have better access to jobs and so forth. And then you're really affecting these outcomes in a very positive way that you, it's not just about going to the doctor and, you know, making sure you're taking the right medication. It's really about like starting from the onset, just having a healthy mentality and making sure that your environment is really set up for success.
So, Steven, now that we, I mean, that we have the problem sort of illustrated, what are the some of the solutions to the issues around food security that you think need to be focused on the most and maybe that you do focus on the course?
Well, certainly, you know, children need to understand where their food comes from. And it's remarkable because I never saw so much farmland as I did in my life in Indiana. But yet children don't know what food is. You know, they think burgers come from the burger aisle. They think tacos come from the taco farm. They don't know what food is. So when you move children from being consumers of food to producing food and they understand the inputs of it, they tend to want to eat it more. And they tend to want to eat things that they grow and have a vested stake in, so to speak. So I've never been the food police. That's not who I am. I believe in programs that attract children around engagement, and project-based learning are game-changing. But, you know, right now, fast forward in the heart, in the midst of this global pandemic, the best way to boost your immunity is through the consumption of fresh fruits and vegetables. So having a program that puts fresh fruits and vegetables at the heart of academic performance in each and every classroom in communities that don't always have access to it, regardless of seasonality, using 90% less water and 90% less space is something I really, really get excited about. And most importantly, so do they. And that's reflected in this film. You see child after child getting excited about new tastes, new things that they can grow, new experiences, and the whole notion of nurture. Because when you teach children about nature, you teach them about nurture. And when we teach children to nurture, we as a society collectively embrace our better nature. This work is really about growing something greater. And I like to say, in these very trying times, both before the pandemic and certainly after, let compassion be the new curriculum. Because when you teach kids to be compassionate and empathetic and kind and collaborative, which is what you're going to see throughout this film, and that's why it's so aptly titled Generation Growth, you're going to see children and communities and schools and communities growing together. And that's what this is all about.
About 30 seconds left, Moo. Were you in production on this during the pandemic at all, or was it finished before March rolled around?
No, it's been about 2 years since we started filming. So we filmed for about a year. We wrapped in May of last year, and we've just been in post-production the whole time. Obviously, the pandemic slowed a lot of things down, you know, getting post-production during a pandemic and having to do music and color while remote is a very, very challenging thing. So it took us a little while to finally finish the film. But, you know, I'm actually very thankful that we were finished before the pandemic started. Because that really would have hampered us from finishing the film.
Moo Sun and Steven Ritz are behind the documentary Generation Growth, part of this year's Heartland International Film Festival, which is being held virtually and starts this week. Moo and Steven, thanks again for talking with us, and good luck with the festival. Steven, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much. I hope you join me on October 11th at the Tibbs Drive-In. Look for the guy with the cheese hat. I'll be handing out popcorn.
Moo, much obliged.
Thank you so much.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme. Our podcast can be found wherever you get podcasts. Be sure to subscribe so you always know what we're talking about and you never miss a subject you care about. Tomorrow, we'll have a conversation on after-school programs. We'll learn how some organizations have adapted to the lockdown and what options remain for the kids who need it. In the meantime, we're on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana for topic alerts and discussion. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the movies. This is All In.